beautiful, illuminating, and accurate science books called Can Science Books. Thank you to Jim Pojar and Sibyl Huesler for giving me their time and taking me on little mini tours showing me how to identify plants that live around me. CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.
Thanks to Pamela Hassan for that report. And yeah, great series. They have a whole bunch of other books of a similar purpose, covering different things. Of course, this one, The Coastal Plants, is perhaps was the sort of granddaddy of it all, and a great book. But then they have ones covering, like, you know, the coastal tidal zones. You can go out to identify all the plants and creatures that you see along the shore and in tidal pools and stuff, and a nice sort of pocket thick but pocket sized bird book, and many others. And if you like getting out into the woods or out into the wild and actually knowing what it is you're walking through and seeing, and I recommend checking them out.
I like to just weigh in with just very briefly. I attempted, I guess it was 7 years ago, to do. Could I do plant classification, like not just of this area, but in general? I found it very complex. But one thing I did find out, the ancient Greeks were basically incorrect about this. They classified plants with herb, herb, shrub, and tree. Now, what that basically is classifying is wood. How much wood the plant is doing. A herb has no wood, a shrub has some wood, and a tree has a lot of wood. And wood production of a plant allows it to last more than 1 year, because herbs, like a dandelion, it's done for in that 1 year. Roses actually come are part of a shrub. It comes from that wood base. And a tree, of course. And you can have a herb being related to a tree, for example. Just something I thought to add to all this. And also, for the upcoming tomato article, there was a court case in the United States in the late 19th century about whether or not a tomato was a vegetable or fruit. Scientifically, it's considered a fruit, but it was a point of taxation. They wanted to tax it like a vegetable, or vice versa. So, I don't know if you ever heard about that court case.
I think I did, actually. It's still an ongoing debate about tomatoes.
Anyway, so scientifically, it's a fruit, though. It's just that you don't think in terms of having a fruit pie, do you? It's more like a berry pie, blueberry pie. So yeah. So we're going to have tomato production.
Yeah, although I'm seeing that there seems to be an issue with the file. It doesn't appear that the whole file is there, so I'm going to have to check that out. We might not be able to run it today.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, so anyway, first we'll give you a bit of more about birds.
Okay.
Time now for gardening. Oh, that's not what I wanted.
This is Bird Note. As the tides fall in Cape May, New Jersey, these American oyster catchers are living up to their name. The crow-sized shorebirds are mostly black and white, except for bright yellow eyes and a long orange bill. American oyster catchers are shellfish specialists that can be found foraging in intertidal zones along the U.S. Atlantic shoreline and both coasts of Central and South America. Their unmistakable bills allow them to smash up and scarf down oysters, clams, and other bivalves, attracting the attention of birders and mollusk-mooching seabirds. Sadly, researchers estimate that between 1970 and 2023, American oyster catchers lost roughly half their population to habitat degradation, human disturbance, and predation by mammals like coyotes, raccoons, and domestic cats. We can all do our part to conserve American oyster catchers by giving them space on shared beaches, keeping domestic pets indoors or on leash, and cutting fossil fuel emissions that drive climate change. You'll find more actions you can take to protect birds at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel. This episode is dedicated to Bob Goodale, whose lifelong love for birds and nature continues to inspire.
Fionn is a Vancouver-based band. They got a new release out called Scum, and they're a sister duo, and they've had quite a good success on Canadian charts last year. This album came out a couple months ago. This track is called "Bad at Being Good." Bad at being casual. Fionn and Bad at Being Casual from their album Scum. They're from right here in Vancouver, actually, I think, based out of White Rock.
Well, how long have they been operating?
They're quite a while. I mean, they're currently in their, I think, maybe their mid-20s, but they've been performing since they were teens. They're 25, but they've been going for like 10 years.
What happened was that the woman who attempted to assassinate under Andy Warhol did something called the Scum Manifesto. And she was an ex-prostitute lesbian, current lesbian at the time. And she didn't kill him, but he was in pain for 19 years. It was quite terrible anyway.
And just to be clear, Fionn aren't any of those things.
Well, I know that, but it just kind of reminded me. There's a movie that I shot Andy Warhol.
Yeah.
Now, we're going to go before my topic about the Great Tomato Court case.
Because, of course, we've had an issue with our recording for Gardening with Embark, so we're not going to be able to bring you that full one, but we will bring that back for next week, because lots of people grow tomatoes and want to know about it, but you're going to talk about
it
now.
I'm going to prepare this, because I got it right on. So what happened was that scientifically, it is a fruit. Now, the thing is about, I'm just going to talk about the science. The science is undisputed.
Yep.
So it is a fruit. It's just that you don't think, oh, I have blueberry pie, I have apple pie, and those are fruits. A tomato pie, oh, well, that's not quite it, you know. But what happened?
And of course, it's a fruit because it has seeds. The definition of a fruit is that it has seeds.
From a
blueberry is a seed. Apples have a seed. Oranges have seeds.
This is from the McGoogle. In the famous 1893 Supreme Court case in the United States.
Important issues.
Nix versus Hidden. The court ruled that tomatoes must be classified as vegetables rather than fruits. This was, but it was about tax tariffs and custom purposes. So the thing is that they wanted to tax it because under the Tariff Act of 1883, imported vegetables were taxed at 10%, while fruits were imported tax-free. Anyway, so it was just a tax grab. Now, vegetable is not a scientific classification. A vegetable is something, is a plant that is not a fruit or a seed or a nut that you can eat. Like you know, you can eat it, I would say. It's sort of a colloquial thing. So
kind of a catch-all term.
You could say that tomato is both because, you know, as I say, you can't have tomato pie, really.
I mean, certainly the way we use a tomato is much, generally speaking, much closer to how we would use other vegetables, as typically in a savory dish as opposed to a sweet dish. Because I guess tomatoes can have a lot of sugars in them as well, but we typically use tomato in a savory fashion, like in sauces and on their own. And, you know, and we don't typically, like you say, put them in pies.
So anyway, that's preparing us for next week. Now then, on to my talk.
Well, let's do a quick promo for what's coming up tomorrow not tomorrow, but later today. Some of our programming from later today.
Something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something everyday, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday, you heard that right, Monday, from 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.
Tune in tomorrow on Speak Up. Host Danny Nesvadarani will be sharing an interview about a series of death cafes that have been popping up around East Van the past year with its lead host, Ava Quissy. Later in the hour, an interview with Vancouver City Councillor Sean Orr on introducing a low-income transit pass. That's tomorrow on Speak Up, happening at 10 o'clock. And on Wednesday on Intravenous, host Nicole Hines will be sharing an interview that she did with the band Salt Horse, based out of Calgary, talking about their new album Lucky Teeth, and also a preview of the Sled Island Festival in Calgary. Nicole's going to be heading out to that festival next week. So there'll be a lot of information on that. And later in the show, she'll be playing an interview with Kagan Go of the Vancouver-based Chinese-Canadian multidisciplinary artist whose work spans memoir, poetry, playwriting, filmmaking, and mental health advocacy. So all that's coming up on Wednesday on Intervenus, and tomorrow Sean Orr and interview about death cafes on Speak Up Tomorrow with Danny Nesvadarani. So tune in for those coming up this week here, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. And Peter.
So I'm going to go backwards with these Donald Trump cover. He's on the cover of this. And I'm actually going to add one that I just saw.
So you're looking at three different cover features,
right,
about Donald Trump over the years, going back to how far?
I'm going to go in from first to last to begin with. The Playboy an interview, which was on the cover too, in 1990. You know, one thing that Donald Trump is proud about is that this one, the few times a man was on the cover, with a woman, though. There's a woman on it. But actually, Seinfeld...
A lightly dressed woman, presumably?
One woman. Actually, Seinfeld, a few years later, had an interview in Playboy, and he had a telephone booth full of women. He was making it. You know, that thing in the 60s, you're cramming. Yeah. And it was... It had... So he beat Trump that way. Anyway.
So one of the things we should say about Playboy, which people may not...
It no longer exists. It's no longer
in public.
Yeah,
may not be aware of, because they may mostly be think of it as a nudie magazine, and also, you know, the Playboy mansions and all the rest that went with it. And it was, in fact, a nudie magazine. It had nude pictorials of young and attractive women, but it also made a real effort at doing serious journalism in the sense of serious articles and stuff, with the joke being that people got Playboy. I just get it for the articles. But anyway, that's just set up for...
And it was the interview.
Yeah.
The interview. Like, I inherited, when Ken Bornold died in 2006, I got some old Playboys. In fact, I got a 1964 one that Ian Fleming wrote the James Bond novels.
Yep.
And it was done after he died. It was published 4 months after he had died. So that's an example. They would have pretty high-profile people being interviewed.
Yeah, so, I mean, I can think of others. Jimmy Carter was interviewed
prior to
on the presidency.
That's right.
John Lennon was interviewed in the mid-70s. Loads of people. It was, you know, a different take on it. And apparently, they're quite old issues in good condition are quite collectible.
Not them. I got a few in not so great condition from Ken Bornold when he died.
Yeah.
Anyway, so and then in 1994, he was on the cover of Vanity Fair with his then new wife, who he married just after she gave birth, actually. Mm. And he had divorced the first wife in 1990, but he had an affair with this woman starting in 1985. She had a child in, like, the middle of 1993. They got married about 2 months later. And then there was
Who was that?
It's a second wife.
Okay.
Okay. It's... Anyway, so... then in March of 1994, there was a cover story on Vanity Fair. And part of that one, I'm going to come back. Well, maybe I'll deal with this one in depth first. This was a resurrection of Trump, because he never personally filed bankruptcy, but his companies did, starting in 1991. Mm-hmm. He was not in the greatest financial shape as such, but this was the resurrection of the Trump brand.
Right.
And he was the Art of the Deal was published in 1987, where supposedly he knew the Art of the Deal. And this was the way, well, he still knows it in some manner. The other thing is that on the cover is him, his second wife, and the baby. And it said, Trump Family Values. Now, the thing about this is that I always kind of remembered this thing, and I always thought he had done constantly cover articles as Vanity Fair, but I guess not. But it's sort of like you don't know the whole story. Go, he's got family values. Oh, that's very interesting. He had been going to Epstein Island since the late 80s. Yeah. He had this affair with that woman while married to the number one.
Yeah.
And he quit going to the relation with Epstein in the beginning of the 00s. Then he married the current wife, number three, in 2005. Yeah. So that's sort of, but as I say, that's what, and not only is it the resurrection, it's that I'm a family person. This woman had my child and I had to marry her. I just, whatever. It was sort of a, but Vanity Fair, I'm sort of thinking, where were they thinking of? Now, Vanity Fair, the incarnation that we know is 1983. But there was another incarnation earlier than all of that, that it was a revival of an older publication that had a bit of a reputation. That was 1913 to 1936. And it was sort of part of the of the Roaring Twenties. You know, it was part of the whole thing that there was Vanity Fair. In fact, in the 1967 film Thoroughly Modern Millie, which is set in the 1920s, a reference in one of the lyrics is made to Vanity Fair, which didn't exist during that time because it was resurrected in 1983, and it exists to this very day.
Right.
Now, what's your opinion overall of the publication, Magnus?
I haven't really followed it closely for a number of years, but, you know, I mean, my feelings about Vanity Fair was it had a lot of interesting articles and a lot of culture stuff, but a lot of really, really annoying pandering to rich folks.
There, and the ultimate pandering was perhaps the March 1994 article.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm wondering if I couldn't really find proof of some engineering on some parts, like I'll scratch your back, you'll scratch mine, whether I couldn't really find any information on that. But, I would call it kind of a shallow publication. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, like it has some good articles and it has, you know, the... You know, a lot of the reviews and sort of art criticism can be quite good. But then it has these, you know, puff pieces about whoever, you know, rich folks or the kids are rich folks. And they're just, you know, they're just meant to puff them up and, you know, and it kind of turned me off.
Well, it's sort of style over substance. Yeah. And even when it's sort of a, like... Even the articles of substance are of a certain type, you know. That's my opinion. I think it's. Who was the photographer? Who is no longer with them, and he had a style.
Fran Lebowitz.
Yeah, that's right. And I had a confrontation 30 years ago at the Vancouver Public Library because he came to town, and I said, "Well, what about you're doing American Express ads, and supposedly you have to charge? It's the only card you have to pay $50 a year." And everybody booed me, and they said I was bringing up a non-issue. But that's dealt with anyway. Now what I found out just this morning is that prior to Rolling Stone having the cover article on Donald Trump in 2015, Time magazine had one.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of, and I was trying to figure, like, why, what was the thinking of Rolling, why did it do this? And what it was that this was the third cover article. One was the Hollywood Reporter had done a cover article, and Time magazine had.
Mm-hmm.
And the cover just has a face of Donald Trump, and it says, deal with it. Like, yeah, we unfortunately had to. Now, I just found out that Time had done it, which is not good. But I'm going to be very critical of Rolling Stone doing an article at all on Donald Trump to just bring up the possibility of it. I read the article, and it doesn't really It's critical, but it's not overtly critical of Trump.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like saying, oh, well, things are so crazy, maybe this will work, kind of thing. And the article ends with...
When was this article from?
September 2015.
Okay.
So it's even prior to 2016, which was the election year.
Yeah, I was going to say he probably hadn't even... Had he even declared at that point?
No, no. Okay. And so he had gone down the escalator. But I really think it's reprehensible, a rolling stone, to have done it, because I think this basically instigated the presidency. The other two media entities that followed through was CNN, because they said, oh, we're getting more ratings. He's going to explode.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't. The other is Saturday Night Live, because he hosted Saturday Night Live in 2016. And it's rather ironic that the three media entities are so upset about Donald Trump were Rolling Stone, CNN, and Saturday Night Live. And I would say they sort of instigated the presidency. He didn't have to advertise in 2016. He got free advertising because they thought he was just going to implode. It's just funny.
Well, I would have to... I recall that during that campaign, he hardly had to spend any money on TV ads. Like, raising money and spending on TV ads was a huge part of any other candidate's campaign strategy. And Donald Trump hardly needed to do that at all, because he got so much free media coverage from every news organization. And I'm sure that, you know, Saturday Night Live and Rolling Stone and Vanity Fair and others, or CNN. Yeah, I mean, my recollection is people just didn't think he was going to get elected, and I think that
he did.
I know, but I think what happened is, and this is not to excuse him, but you know, they were happy to give him airtime because he was always kind of outrageous and attention getting, which is what they wanted.
And ratings, it comes down.
Yeah,
to
yeah,
ratings.
But they never really thought he was really going to get elected, and he did, and partly because of, you know, all the time and attention that all the media gave him that year, and they still do, you know.
Well, the other thing I can say about Rolling Stone magazine is that during the 1980s, they had advertisements for the American military.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do be all you can be kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which, whose side are these guys on at the end? Whoever gives us the money or something? I don't know. I mean, that also I find with Rolling Stone as an institution, I find it a problem that they had advertising for the American military. I don't think they still have it, but they did during the 1980s.
Well, the Trump news for today is that apparently there is a deal of sorts to end the war, the Iran war, that both the Trump, the Iranians, and the Pakistanis, who are acting as mediators, have all said this exists and is going to happen. But apparently it's pretty high level. There's all the tricky issues have been kicked down the road. You know, they're going to stop the blockade, and Iran's going to open the Strait of Hormuz, and then they're going to negotiate about other stuff. Still very difficult is whether Iran and Hezbollah in Lebanon are going to stop.
But Israel is also an instigator.
Israel and Hezbollah are going to stop shooting at each other, which Iran is demanding. And we'll see if Trump can
push that. Well, the thing about Israel, some people say they were the instigators of it in some ways.
And, you know, the trickiest issues of what's going to happen to Iran's nuclear program has been kicked down the road. So who knows how they're going to get a...
Well, the Obama administration handled that because there was no way they were going to have inspectors all the time looking at it. And the fact that we were in danger of them building a bomb is ridiculous, basically.
Yeah, it seemed to be dealt with under that agreement. Well, that's all our time for today. Thanks for that, Peter.
Okay.
Great discussion. Thanks for the history of the tomato. It's time for Democracy Now! Coming up in a few seconds. Tune in tomorrow for more Speak Up at 10 o'clock.
This